Thank you for coming over to talk about the Black Patch War remembrances are occurring around our region. And I'd like to establish the meat of it.
Well, I think the first thing is that it is a complex series of events. It's not a single event. It is a period of time in which a number of issues come to a head in West Kentucky. They're separate issues. And even though there's a certain commonality of the sort of violent or vigilante style of response, it's not an organized and coherent response by the same group of people with the same leadership throughout the period. I mean, there is a development, and the group initially starts with one set of objectives, releases, if you will, a genie out of the bottle, and is unable to put the genie of vigilanteism back into the bottle. And so while the initial effort was to gain more leverage for the farmers against the tobacco trust, it then goes through a phase when vigilante violence is directed at people who violate community social mores, who are perceived as other. And those are not necessarily the same people, but they are using the same tactics and the same cover and some of the same rhetoric. And then at its end, it directs itself very much at maintaining order and keeping African Americans in their perceived place. And by that time, it's an almost entirely different group of people, but using the same tactics and methods. And so it tends to look like there's more continuity and coherence than there really is. But once the genie of vigilante violence is let out of the bottle and given social sanction, all kinds of individuals can use it for their own purposes. And that's essentially what happens over time.
The beginning event, the decision to form an association, a local association, instead of dealing with the Duke people.
Well, it was an attempt to bring the farmers in Kentucky and Tennessee together so that they could collectively deal with this new entity, the Tobacco Trust, rather than trying to deal with a large, distant corporation one by one. And really, it's an attempt by local people to establish some kind of control over their economic lives in a world that has completely changed in their lifetime. I mean, Kentucky was one of the wealthiest states in the Union before the Civil War, and by 1904, it's one of the poorest. Agriculture in Kentucky was a very profitable enterprise up through the Civil War. By 1904, these guys are struggling to make a living. They're dealing with impersonal market forces. They're competing with farmers in Turkey. They don't necessarily even understand the world anymore. And so the Tobacco Trust and Duke, in a sense, personify everything that they see has changed their world. And they want to get together and get control. And of course, the danger of that is that anyone who then chooses not to join them and help them becomes not just an outsider or not just a difficult person, but another threat to their existence and their survival. And that's why there's so much violence directed at individuals, people brought out of the house in the middle of the night and lashed, vandalism and threats made to try to force people to join the movement because they really see it as a struggle for life and death, and they've lost faith in the government and the courts to protect them.
What are the turning points? You've got the vigilantes threatening people. Where does their trajectory change?
Well, as long as Dr. David Amos is in Kentucky and in charge, he manages to keep a fairly tight focus on things. Their energy is directed at getting people in line to join the group and showing signs of force and strength. I mean, the raids where they burn the tobacco warehouses are really meant to show their strength and to, you know, get attention. You need to deal with us. If you don't deal with us on our terms, there are serious consequences. The Tobacco Trust is held to be unconstitutional in the middle of this, and that changes the market. But also Amos leaves West Kentucky. He was in the Princeton area, in a little village town called Cobb, and goes to New York City with his son to practice medicine. And without his strong leadership, other individuals began using the model of the night rider, the vigilante visiting the offender to enforce their own personal agendas, their own personal grudges. The reason this is in the New York Times is that This fits in with the national image of Kentucky as a kind of violent, lawless place, which has the Hatfield and McCoys and a whole variety of feuds and disputations in eastern Kentucky. And this is another example of the sort of lawlessness and violence that's endemic with Kentucky, which really hurts Kentucky's economy because it repels investment. No one in the East is going to invest significant capital in what's perceived to be a lawless, violent society. And, of course, that we know that that's not most Kentuckians are about even then, but the government is ineffective in dealing with the feuds and the Black Patch War to a considerable extent. And so you have this eruption of violence, and then people with other grievances almost see this as a green light that they too can use violence to obtain their ends, to put pressure on the guy who's selling bootleg liquor. We'll visit him and, you know, let him know the will of the community, the less than morally straight-laced individual. We will get to visit them at night and let them know that. And it's largely because of the loss of faith in the government and the court system. The initial mission to restore some kind of economic balance between the tobacco grower and the trust that's buying tobacco seemed like a morally valid crusade and seemed to, you know, in a sense, give license or justification. We have to do something. We're in a serious situation and no one else will help it. But once you move beyond that, and individuals feel that they have license to enforce their particular view, or small groups of individuals enforce their particular view on others, that's when it escalates and becomes a little harder to justify and harder to say, I understand that.
Were these individuals and groups of individuals largely anonymous?
Oh, they were deliberately anonymous. I mean, they were masked. Their horses were camouflaged with coverings because in a small rural community, you know, it's just like knowing your neighbor's car. I mean, you might not see the face of the person, but if you could see the horse clearly, you knew pretty well who it was. They at least are visibly masked, which is, of course, a tradition of vigilante violence that goes back in Europe to the chivalry and was used by the Ku Klux Klan. A lot of the tactics are borrowed from the Ku Klux Klan and its efforts to intimidate African Americans to not vote. The nighttime visit by masked horsemen, random acts of violence, and it's largely designed to instill fear. You either do what we want you to do, or you will face these consequences, and no one will be able to help you.
When did the conflict and the vigilantism quiet down and fade into the background, or did it?
Well, obviously it did, because we don't live with it now. And the governor did send out the national, what was then the militia, to patrol and try to maintain order. There are a number of lawsuits that are brought, some of them unsuccessful because local juries simply refuse to convict the people who are accused. But that sort of puts things on notice that, you know, the tide is turning. You know, people are being prosecuted. People are being arrested. Amos himself is tried and not convicted. And so the legal system does begin to assert itself. People begin to, you know, resist the violence. But it continues sporadically, really, until the outbreak of the First World War. And then it settles down, in part because there are economic changes in the agricultural economy, the beginnings of more crop diversification. And so the economic pressure reduces. The state government becomes more effective in at least prosecuting people, if not necessarily convicting them. So there begin to become consequences for acting outside the law. It was never more, you know, than a relatively small proportion of the whole population of the purchase. But as in a lot of these groups, other people were willing to give them cover because at least initially they seemed to be doing something that was in the public interest, combating the tobacco trust. And so it's a fluid situation that evolves over time. And, you know, I think Amos managed to keep it fairly tightly focused on the economic grievances. But once he's off the scene, it tends to splinter a little bit and become a little more diverse in its interests and a lot less directed. It becomes almost undirected in that it's individuals acting for personal, Christopher Waldrop in his very, very good book on this, talks about individuals simply settling grudges and old scores and using the mechanism of the Knight Rider when it's really not protecting the community's interests any longer. It's satisfying, a personal grudge that they have.
Thanks for your perspective on the Black Patch Wars.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime.